Welcome. You are listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's better to hear it live, this is the place to catch the latest sermon, conversation, and select program. If you like what you're hearing or want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to get a notification for our next episode. Enjoy and see you in shul.
What a total joy and privilege it is to be here with two awesome women. This month in March of Women's History Month, it just seemed like the right and perfect time to do this. So, Elizabeth, first of all, just congratulations on a tremendous book. We have book sales afterwards if you want to buy a book, and Elizabeth will sign your book if you want. So please buy them afterwards. But let me just start by asking you, what inspired you to write this book?
Lots of different things. As we talked about, I have dedicated my life to taking care of women, and I've always been fascinated by the experience of illness. I majored in the history of science and trying to understand that science doesn't exist in a vacuum, but is formed by those who create it, envision it, conduct it. And when it comes to women's medicine and taking care of women, I have been privy to not just dealing with women with cancer, but really this existential idea of what does it mean to be alive. And for women, I've seen so many obstacles from a medical standpoint, heartbreaking stories of feeling invalidated, shamed, blamed, embarrassed for their own bodies, and wanting to really at some point be enraged enough to do something about it. We don't talk about women being angry, but at some point I think I just said enough is enough in clinic one day, and I really felt inspired to go back in time and unpack the legacy that I think we inherit as physicians when we show up at the doctor's office, but even more so as patients.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because you open the book with not women being angry, but being embarrassed and apologetic, yeah. Right? Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how it shows up?
So the first, I think you're referring to the very beginning of the book.
Yeah.
So in the beginning of the book, I describe a woman on her deathbed. She's dying of breast cancer. And I go to visit her in the hospital, and, you know, she's hours from death and she's still able to speak. And I go in to hug her, and she apologized to me for sweating on her. It's the first thing she said to me. I'm so sorry. I'm sweating on your face. She would not be the first woman to apologize to me on her deathbed for something like that, nor will I think she'll be the last. And when I thought about really how I wanted to open this book, the publisher, the editor said to me, you know, I'm a little concerned about how sad this is. And we took a little bit of a gamble. I felt very compelled to share what I thought was an important story that really captured just how much women carry this shame with them, carry this sense of apology, even on their deathbed.
Great. This is really an unfair question. Can you summarize the book in 2 minutes? Can you give a brief history of the history of women's medicine and women's bodies as just a general overview?
Well, I can tell you how the book was structured. So, in wanting to tackle all of women's health, I thought about, well, how do we learn about medicine and women's bodies in medical school? And so what I did was, in addition to walking through history, was trace a walk through a woman's body, the same way we learn in medical school, which is by organ system. So when you're in physiology class, the body is fragmented in the same way that we learn about specialties today. So whether it's cardiovascular system, neurology, urology, gastroenterology. So the book is a walk through women's bodies in the same way we learn about them in medical school to really highlight what we've gained, but also what we leave behind in that process, and to build that out by going all the way back to the Greeks and the Egyptians to current narratives today, patients' experiences today, and interviews with physicians in each of those specialties.
Great. And Lisa, do you want to share a little bit about your practice to start with, to give some people some context?
Sure. Well, first of all, I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book.
It was riveting.
It was compelling. And as I went through it, it was very interesting how much I knew, but didn't realize why I knew something or things that I didn't really understand. So my current practice is as an internist. I'm here in the neighborhood. And not only do I see women, but I also see male patients. And I actually see some transgender patients, which kind of could be a whole new area for your next book. Mm-hmm. And doing so, I'd say about 70% of my patient population are women of various ages, from high school age young women all the way up until their 90s. Being in a position where I'm caring for male patients as well actually lends a lot to what you write in your book, particularly with regard to emotions and feelings and how women perceive themselves and how they particularly perceive themselves as when they're ill or when they're care of a doctor. And I could definitely support a lot of the comments that you make regarding historical and what's going on presently. There's definitely a vast difference in what I see for autoimmune disease in my practice. I don't even know if I can mention more than one or two male patients who suffer from an autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. I can easily tell you that my male patients have no qualms pulling down their pants, showing me anything and everything that bothers them, and being very open about where they are with regard to, let's say, their sexual health or genital urinary issues. And I definitely noted that area of your book. And I can tell you that my female patients, even with a female practitioner, it takes a lot of effort sometimes to still get women to open up and own their body and feel comfortable speaking about their body and issues that, whether they're directly mentioned or not, are there and are of concern.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Elizabeth, so in your book, as you go through the chapters, you give like some very specific examples in each system of a sort of sometimes egregious past practices. And so do you want to share one or two examples of the history of the male understanding, the male doctor's understanding of the women's bodies, some of their like anxieties around like women's sexuality? They missed so much about the differences between women's bodies and men. One of the places that I was really interested in was Osler, Dr. Osler, mm-hmm. And how much he, what he, and you can talk a little bit about cardiology and what he missed. But I have to say it was actually, I went to my elementary school was called Sir William Osler, and I'm like, oh no, you know, because it was sort of very eye-opening. So do you want to share one or two anecdotes about...
Yeah, we can talk about my friend, Sir William Osler.
Yeah.
I didn't know where we were going, if we were going to the sex direction or there, but well, I'll cover
no,
Osler.
No, but I was just kind of opening up a little bit of a little bit of like a place where listening to the female patients, like where it was particularly egregious in terms of listening to female patients and their concerns. And also, I think the sexuality piece, like those are two pieces that sort of highlighted, you know, came up in the book for me a lot.
I'm going to give you three Perfect. Choices.
Great.
So we'll see which one sits. Well, you said listening to women. I think that there was a lot of not listening to women.
Yes.
And that when we did listen to women, we didn't really want to hear what they have to say. So one of the things that was really shocking to me was, and I know we have some mental health professionals here, was, you know, you could be put in an asylum if you expressed your political views, if you disagreed with your husband. There were thousands and countless women who were put in asylums at the turn of the 19th century. And there was this famous doctor who in 1922, the New York Times referred to as just this pioneering psychiatrist who was going to fix, oh, we've got a psychiatrist here too, who's going to fix, you know, women's just insanity, right? Our hysterical nature. So this man's name was Henry Cotton, and he had this brilliant idea. Well, of course, straitjackets were terrible, and this was absolutely humane. We had to get rid of straitjackets. But if you really listen to these crazy women who had these political views, and maybe they even wanted to vote, their husbands were bringing them to this famous asylum, Trenton, in Trenton, New Jersey. And he had this brilliant idea. Well, when you hallucinate, sometimes it's because you have a fever, right? So these crazy women must have some infection that we haven't discovered. So where did he think this infection, these focal infections came from that were making women so crazy? Well, their teeth. So these women would get admitted to the asylum. Thousands of women went through this, and they would have all of their teeth removed. They could be in their 20s and then require permanent, you know, dentures just to ever eat again. Well, if after you removed all their teeth, they were still not cured, then, well, maybe it was your gallbladder that would be taken out, or your uterus, or part of your colon, because your colon must somehow be infected. He claimed an 85% cure rate 30% of these women died. I never knew this history till I read this book. And I mean, that was just one of the examples that just blew my mind. The second point you asked about was about, you know, just sort of sexuality. I think the other thing that blew my mind in writing this book was just how much the fear of women's sexuality, the need to control it, the need for women to not express it, infiltrated every aspect of medicine from head to toe. So whether it was why women have scoliosis, why they may have asthma, why they could have autoimmune diseases, somewhere in there was some absolutely insane reference to their sexual drive. I was like, is this really happening again? So you'll see that that's woven throughout the book. The third thing you mentioned was Sir William Osler. So he is he's a famous cardiologist, but internist who founded the residency program at Hopkins and is really renowned for some extraordinary things in medicine. And he's a great example where the book is not about just saying all these men that came before us were horrible. He had good intentions. He did great things. But what did he also do? He said, well, women should absolutely not go to medical school. There's a great article in the Washington Post where one of the first female physician, medical students at Hopkins is walking by him. And he said, are you here for medical school? And she says, well, yes, I am, Dorothy. I think she was a Jewish last name too. Mm-hmm. I forgot, Menden, something or other, but it definitely sounded Jewish. I was like, there we go. And she says, yes, I'm here for medical school. And he said, go home. Right. So this same man, I went back to, because he's famous for his diagnostic skills with a stethoscope, I went back in time to say, well, what did he say about women's heart disease? Because we know today that heart disease is the number one killer of women. And you may have heard maybe from your doctor or maybe in the lay press that the way that women present with heart attack symptoms is atypical. This is the language we learned in medical school, that it's not the classic, and you can tell mm-hmm. us how women present. It's not the classic, like, elephant on the chest, like the white-haired executive in the middle of, like, Wall Street clutching his chest and falling down. Women can present with a whole host of other symptoms, and we refer to that as atypical. Well, going all the way back in time with Sir William Osler's turn-of-the-century treatise on cardiovascular disease, I went and looked at his case reports of how he described the overworked executive and the heart attack symptoms that he had. And then case by case, he refers to them by first letter, Miss C, Miss B, Miss C, Miss A. What did they all have? They had neurotic angina. When they presented with chest pain, angina is chest pain. Every single one of the cases he dismisses as not actually having heart disease. So much so that at the end of his descriptions of all these case reports, he says, these women do not die. But they do, and it's the number one killer of women. So that's an example of tracing where's the legacy of where we go wrong to this day and why we're missing heart disease in women. Let's go back to the first man in the United States who really came up with how we should be thinking about heart disease.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah. Lisa, were there examples in the book that particularly resonated with you and you saw like, oh gosh, I see that in my practice still, or I understand now how women come to me with this reticence or these issues?
So I think as a little bit of a gross generalization, but to some degree it's true, particularly with older generations and sometimes my patients who may not be as educated or sophisticated or as empowered as the community we have here. They come in apologetic. They come in frequently presenting a little too late because instead of being feeble or frail or neurotic or hysterical, which is definitely a word that has a common theme throughout the book, I actually find they're quite stoic. Or they have so many things that they're doing that in the moments of symptoms, they will push through something and then dismiss it and move ahead. Mm-hmm. And you know, sadly, for some of these women that I've seen, whether it be because of heart disease mm-hmm. or because of a cancer that's found too late, I almost feel that women have kind of had ingrained in them an opportunity to be dismissive of symptoms. Oh, just push on. Oh, I have to pick up a kid. And they don't always present on time, or they'll come in apologizing for still not feeling well, or the big word I will hear is, I know I'm being anxious. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about this. I'm embarrassed to say this. I know I'm being anxious. Mm-hmm. And I've decided anxious is a really ugly word when we use it. And the other day in the office, a patient was using it. And I said, Mindy, how about we take that word away and we use the word concerned? And she said, oh, I like that so much better. Mm. And so it kind of diffused the situation and in a way almost like validated that she had a real issue. So what I would say, and I probably have talked in three different circles at this point, that women have to listen to their bodies, that we all have guts and instincts. And if you feel that the practitioner you're with isn't getting you or understanding you, or if you're getting the here, take this, or it's okay, or dare I say it's all in your head, or you're just being anxious, step back a moment, think about it, talk to a friend, have a friend go with you to a doctor's appointment. I often think that for the majority of practitioners out there, doctor visits are very technical, they're very fast. And with regard to even your book, when you talk about the missing voice of the female patients or patient cases, my background is in humanities. So for me, it's all about the patient narrative, which is almost the opposite of what goes on these days. And if we go back to old-fashioned medical training, technically speaking, if you let the patient talk, if you listen to the patient, you should be able to get close to the diagnosis 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. Not because a woman who's in here calls me and says, I'm being sent for a mammogram. Why? Because I have breast pain. Well, who told you that? My doctor. Well, did he see you? No, but he said, I need an exam. Okay. I make a house call because I know this person. This person doesn't need a mammogram. They needed to be seen in the office because they have a rip-roaring case of shingles, which ironically was on the left side of the chest. So probably if she said, I'm having chest pain rather than breast pain on the left side, she would have gone right to the emergency room. So I think it's really important to listen and to ask the questions that you want to ask and go in there prepared to ask your questions and not be pushed to the side.
It's so interesting because a lot of times I'm asked, well, what's the path forward? And there was a drug that was recently developed called Linzess for irritable bowel syndrome, which is really a female predominant disorder. And it was a man that helped develop this drug. And I was at a conference recently where he was on a panel and he said, the real key to the success of this drug and changing really the course of this disease for women was actually listening to them, listening to how they presented with symptoms of bloating, how they presented with pain, and how they described it in their own words. Because we both come from a place of narrative medicine and the stories that we tell ourselves about our bodies, the stories that are told to us, and the stories that we inherit. I have a question for you, though.
Oh, great. Okay.
So when you talk about like women enduring and women being stoic, there is a long thread, I think, throughout history of, again, this, well, we were, you know, we're made to endure the pain of childbirth. We're made to endure the pain of our, like, painful periods. All of these diagnoses are missed associated with menstruation because the assumption is, oh, this is what my mother went through. This is what my grandmother went through. Do you think, I mean, how does that maybe relate to the idea of original sin? And, I mean, is original sin only a Christian
term? It's kind of a Christian term, but that's okay.
It's all good. My parents are like, did you not go to Hebrew school?
No.
The idea that, you know, Eve really screwed us over.
Right, right. So it does say in Genesis that because Eve didn't listen to God's instructions, women will suffer the pain of childbirth. The concept of it being a sin is much more of a, I mean, the original sin is much more of a Christian concept, but there is this concept of women suffer the pain of childbirth coming from a woman not listening to instruction. Mm-hmm. So that's the, I don't know if that was what.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the debates, it just shows like the infiltration of religion and culture into medicine. If you look at the debates of when anesthesia came up with childbirth, there were many doctors that said, well, women are meant to endure this pain. If we take away pain, what's going to happen? Are these babies going to be messed up because they haven't gone through this maternal experience of the woman, you know, screaming and like whatever happens?
Right. So it's so interesting because, Lisa, when I heard you say anxious, it's like it feels like it's the hysteria. Like there's still this stigma of women being embarrassed about how they feel. Mm-hmm. It feels like the past is still present in many ways in the way women feel in their doctor's office and the way they think about themselves. Mm-hmm. I just think that it's that is really interesting.
And I was going to make another point, which I can't think of right now. But I know what I was going to ask. I was going to say that Elizabeth, you talked about it in like shame and embarrassment, and Lisa, you brought up this up a little bit, like the issue of incontinence and how even as you said, like even wealthy, empowered, educated, it was that like line was really interesting to me about how people who you expect to be able to advocate for themselves, like you were having, I forget, lunch
that was,
or something.
That was the Park Avenue Synagogue crowd. We were hanging out in the summer. And, you know, I got like really excited about all these dorky things that I've been reading about. I'm reading about like incontinence in the 1850s, guys, you know, and everyone's like drinking their wine and on a beach and not so interested. But I said, no. When you're like going for a run and you're jumping rope and you're peeing in your pants a little bit, that's not normal. And there was a group of women that just kind of looked at me like embarrassed. Well, but isn't that what happens to all of us after, you know, we have babies? Like, I'm going to laugh so hard or should I pee in my pants? And that, the idea that there's a whole field of urology that, think about urology for a second. Do you think about women's needs in that field? Or are you all visualizing like male genitalia? Because that's how I would think about it historically.
So, and yet, it's totally different now, or rather it should be.
It should be, but I think a lot of women don't realize that they're suffering with urinary issues and that there are doctors, men and women, who can help with that.
So to follow up on that, I actually did a study in medical school on stress urinary incontinence. And it was kind of, I'm a little bit older than you, it was kind of back when the field of urogynecology was just developing. And so basically it was kind of melding some of the skills of what urologists have in treating urinary issues for men with the general gynecological skills. And actually the two other people working on the study were men. And we were looking to see the procedures being done at Mount Sinai, who did it better, the gynecologists or the urologists? At that time, urologists did a little bit of a better job, but this is over 20 years ago. But since that time, the amount of breakthrough in minimally invasive procedures, non-surgical procedures, topicals, injections, ointments, behavioral therapy, biofeedback, there's so many new things that we no longer have to say, yes, this is what's naturally happening to my body, but the same way things are naturally happening to a man's body that we've been addressing for many years, we have more opportunity to address things and not just sit back and say, well, I have to take it in stride. Mm-hmm. So with respect to everything you've written, you definitely throw out there some optimism about where we're going. And I think by and large, there is more respect and awareness that we aren't little mini men, mm-hmm. which you beautifully laid out in so many areas of the book. And I think because there are so many more women in medicine, that we as a community of doctors, male and female, in all fairness, are doing much more due diligence so that, you know, the group of women sitting here can feel more empowered to feel better and age better, which is just completely phenomenal to observe and watch. The other thing I will say is I actually do sexual health histories as part of my intake.
And I
do it for men and for women. And it's not so much because I'm looking to see how often someone's having intimate moments. It's really because if there are problems either in interest in intimacy or performance problems, it often relates to either something that might be going on psychologically in terms of depression or anxiety. It could be side effects from medications. For instance, some of the medicines that you use for your patients as breast mm-hmm. cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. It could be because of dynamics going on at home. And this just happened yesterday. I had a male patient in my office and I went through his sexual health history. And he thought he needed some assistance in that department. And I asked him some specific questions, which I won't go into detail. And I said, well, what makes you think you really are having difficulty with intimacy based on these answers? And he replied, well, it's really uncomfortable for my wife. And I said, do you know if your wife has spoken to her doctor about this? So I feel like indirectly, sometimes in treating my male patients, mm-hmm. I hear from them that a lot of women are suffering more than they should be. Mm-hmm. And I kind of indirectly through the husband say, well, you know, if your relationship is as wonderful and strong as it is, maybe encourage her to see her, not necessarily an internist, although I pay a lot of attention to women's health, but even their GYN. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that can be done.
There is a lot that can be done, but I think a lot of doctors are not as incredible as you are. I mean, yes, I work at a great cancer hospital, but we are 2 times more likely to ask men across the board at our, even at our hospital, I think we try to do better, but historically men about sexual side effects from cancer directed therapies than we are women. And in my practice, you know, yes, we have a sexual health department, but that was really slow to form. Mm-hmm. And so it was this idea that we're saving so many women's lives, but we weren't helping them in some of these other important right. areas.
And then the quality of life. I think that's it. There's so much more opportunity to save someone's life mm-hmm. and now hopefully let them have a continuing quality to their life.
Mm-hmm. So I was interested, Elizabeth, also in, like, so we talk about how women haven't been heard or listened to historically, like through, I mean, from the time of like the Greeks, right? So how their voices aren't heard. But but at the end of the book, you talk about your own personal experience mm-hmm. and how even your expert voice was completely discounted. Do you want to share that story? I think it's so illustrative of what still happens in the medical profession.
Yeah. So the reality is, after I wrote all the chapters of the book and was coming to the conclusion, I had this experience in the medical world where I almost didn't want to share it for a variety of provocative reasons. Namely, also that I was very embarrassed. Here I am, this women's health physician. I'm writing a book about advocacy. And when it came to myself and my own health, I was almost a caricature of the woman I had been writing about or trying to write out of history into a new chapter of more empowerment. So I had had a small back surgery, very minor, in November over Thanksgiving. And then I had, about 6 weeks later, I developed a really horrible headache. Every time I would pick my head up, it was as if like my brain was being compressed in a vise. And when I lied down, it felt better and it felt pretty obvious to me. And if anyone's ever had any, you know, an epidural for anything after childbirth, it was, I felt that I was leaking fluid from the original site of the surgery internally. So the fluid that bathes your brain and keeps it kind of swishing around there and the pressure normal is also related to your spine. So I was leaking fluid from the back internally, and I was therefore losing fluid from around my brain. And so every time I picked my head up, I had less fluid around my brain. And it was as if it was being sucked down into my spinal cord. So I was in excruciating pain. And I said to a friend, I think that she was not in medicine. I said, I think I'm leaking spinal fluid. And she was very supportive, said, well, what do you do for that? And I said, I think I'm going to need a blood patch. I think I'm going to need to get this fixed. So she was very kind and very sweet about this. But we were also at a party and there was another physician there. And I said, I think I'm leaking spinal fluid. And he said, oh, you're absolutely effing crazy. And he was not in that field. And then I proceeded to then carry over what he said my diagnosis was when I went to reach out to my surgeon. So I reached out to my surgeon, but I didn't want to bother him and I didn't want to call him. So I figured if I emailed him, he would read it at his leisure. So I changed the title of my email away from what I thought, which was a spinal fluid leak, to something called occipital neuralgia, basically a compressed nerve. The full story is not in the book, but the full story is, he said I had this compressed nerve. The surgeon then basically over email just prescribes me Valium and steroids, none of which would help me. I then see another doctor who says, oh, you have that diagnosis. Let me just see you. I'll inject the back of your head with some lidocaine. We'll just numb it. I end up on the streets of New York City, basically crawling to a cab because I can't lift my head up. The doctor walks by and says, wow, you must really be in a lot of pain. but take the Valium and that will help you, because till the lidocaine kicks in. Still can't lift my head. It's another now 2 days and I finally make my way to an emergency room where I get an MRI and I've got swelling in my brain because this has been going on for so long and I needed to be admitted to the hospital and have a bunch of, eventually the blood patch that I told my friend I needed. But when I finally got to the hospital, I hadn't showered in days because I couldn't pick my head up. And I went to go take my shirt off and like try to do it without lifting my head and put on the gown. And I said to the nurse, you know, I'm so sorry. I just couldn't put on deodorant. I'm in so much pain. But the first thing I said to the nurse was, I'm so sorry. And so for me, I sat there and I thought, oh my God, I went days and days not advocating for myself. I didn't really, you know, there were many moments where I could have advocated for myself. And then when I finally got to the emergency room, I apologized for not wearing deodorant.
So it's an amazing story.
My male patients don't apologize. Yeah, they don't apologize for not having a pedicure. Yeah. My female patients do. My female patients apologize for whatever they think they should have shaved and did not shave. And I say, but I didn't shave for you. But I think part of this is societal too. Yeah. And it kind of goes back to some other areas in your book where, you know, we're first human before we're a doctor or a patient, and there's circuit overload around us about all these ideas about how we're supposed to be, and we carry that with us.
I think, not to pivot a little bit, but I wonder if you think this also relates to women in medicine. So we talk about, oh, it's so great, there are so many women in medicine, but how many women are actually in positions of leadership or actually in the position to listen to develop these new drugs or help design clinical trials? Not as many as there should be. And that's in part because of these expectations. Well, women listen really well. So if you look, and we're more empathic, but that takes a lot of emotional energy and it takes a lot of time. And if you look across the board, there have been study after study that show that women listen longer and take better care of patients and have better outcomes. There's no reason why men can't do that. We just expect women to do that better. But if we're listening longer, we're seeing less patients. If the hospital administrator is saying, oh, you're going to get paid based on how many patients you see, but you're expected to listen longer and spend longer, well, you're not going to get promoted because you've been taking more time with patients, seeing less of them, and you're also not doing research. It's like, it's a lose-lose situation.
It is. I can follow up on that. When I left academics at Cornell, I went into a multi-specialty practice and I was the female physician and I was the internist, but I couldn't be a partner because I was a woman and I'm going to get married. I'm going to have children and I'm going to want to have time with my children. And this is the sad and interesting part of it too, but you're an internist. You don't do procedures, so you can't bill high enough. And so sadly, certain areas of medicine are not compensated as well as others because it's hard to document and prove what you've done. And yet at the end of the day, sometimes holding a hand is more valuable, or finding a moment of quiet so a patient can speak and find out what's been driving this, you know, chronic migraine status they've been having. And we're not paid for that time. And it's incredibly unfortunate. And probably a lot of our healthcare bills would go down if patients could spend time with their physicians, talk to their physicians, instead of just being sent for this test and that test and that test and this test. Oh, and now we found something else, but it's probably nothing, but now we have to send you for this test. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you. The listening, but having the time to listen is key.
Yeah.
And there still is, there's a lot of work still to be done, but you're completely right.
Mm-hmm. How is it being a woman, a female doctor in the field? How was it in medical school? Do your male colleagues disrespect you or disregard you in ways that are subtle or obvious? Do you experience that? Do you experience it from patients? I mean, I get still, you know, oh, you don't look like a rabbi, because people, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, thank goodness there's more female clergy, but there's still a lot of people who are surprised by it. How is it being a female doctor?
I'm gonna go first.
Well, I'm older, so mm-hmm. I'll go first. So I went to medical school at Mount Sinai back in the early 1990s, and our medical school class was pretty much almost 50-50, maybe 47-53, but very close. And it was also actually very ethnically diverse. And again, I was there through like a pilot humanities program. So it was kind of more progressive. Where I trained, which was up at Yale, each of the residency classes was about 36 individuals. My group, we were 5 women out of 36. 2 of them were there with their husbands. And every time we had a gathering, I called it the nurses coming out party, because there was nurses everywhere. And I definitely found there was favoritism towards the male physicians. The female physicians didn't have the nurse come over to say, oh, don't worry, hon, you're tired. Because we also, we didn't have bell commissions, so we worked all night till whenever we finish the next day. I'll take care of the blood cultures for you. I'll do the extra draw for you. So it was interesting seeing that. But I have to say, and you probably feel this way too, we are so blessed training and living in New York and practicing in New York that we have such a cadre of phenomenal female physicians, specialists, and most of my referral patterns probably are to female practitioners. And to follow up on this, sometimes I'll ask a new male patient who comes to me, and it's not because I treat their sister or I treat their wife. I'll say, how did you find me and what brings you here? Well, you're a female doctor. Sometimes I also hear you're a Jewish female doctor. no joke. But men sometimes gravitate to female physicians. And again, I think at the end of the day, it's about who someone is as a human being and their humanity and their compassion. And there shouldn't be a gender that gets attached to those descriptions.
Elizabeth, how do you experience it?
Yeah, I mean, I think depends on at what point of my medical training. So I definitely had some pretty horrific experiences in medical school. I mean, I was touched inappropriately, told how to wear my hair up, down, repeatedly had very disturbing experiences that shaped in many ways why I left Boston and decided to come to New York, where I thought there would be kind of a more vibrant, equitable, less puritanical vibe than maybe Mass General Hospital in Boston. But you know, my journey at MSK was pretty interesting in early fellowship. I had many experiences where how I spoke, how I dressed, how I wore my hair was extremely overanalyzed, and that would be a nice way to put it. But whether it was a picture that I took for a magazine, and I need to think about how men in positions of power are going to view myself with a white coat touching my forearm because that's just too inappropriate. I've had a lot of experiences along the way, and now I'm old enough to not care anymore. but it was pretty. It's been a bumpy road.
Yeah.
Lisa, they've made progress on scrubs though.
Yeah,
because you're even thinner than I am. I mean, we would wear scrubs and you had to wear your t-shirts underneath because they were meant for football players.
Yeah.
And now we have more female and feminine scrubs that fit us appropriately.
But it's interesting, in the breast cancer space, there have been studies, for example, for the female orthopedic surgeons, the shields that they wear to cover themselves for radiation exposure were not properly covering their breasts. So more orthopedic surgeons that were women were being exposed to higher doses of radiation and increasing their risk from breast cancer. Wow. We talk about also instruments for orthopedic surgeons or just surgeons in general. They were built for male hands. So there are lots of ways that we can talk about, oh, no one's getting sexually harassed in the same way anymore. But have we really built out these other subspecialties to honor what women can do?
It's so interesting. When I read the book, so we're going to shift. Lisa, you said some patients come to you about being Jewish. I want to spend a few minutes on the Jewish aspect of this all. It's interesting because, it resonated a lot with me in terms of the absence of women's voices in the patriarchy, because the Jewish tradition is a patriarchal tradition, and we have many thousands of years of our tradition written by men, and there's a notable absence of women's voices. There are some women who show up in the tradition, but there's been a lot of discussion about the absence of women's voices, and then there's a corrective. There's been waves of Jewish feminism, which I sort of see like a parallel to your book, Elizabeth, where it's bringing women's voices in, but it took a long time. But the last, you know, sort of 20, 30 years, there has been a lot of that. But there are a lot of parallels, you know, in terms of the patriarchy and the absence of women's voices between the medical profession and the Jewish world. I do want to ask both of you, does Judaism impact your views of how you view yourself as a doctor? Does it impact the way you practice medicine? Does it have a role at all?
I think there's always that Jewish doctor. Everyone wants to see the Jewish doctor. I think there is this deep moral, ethical compass that comes from Judaism and a humanitarian, charitable sense that you have to do some good in the world. I don't know that I can speak to a biblical passage or know it the way that you do, but just this ingrained sense of I'm here with a purpose and that purpose is beyond myself.
Beautiful. Lisa?
Well, what's the saying? If you've saved one life, you've saved the world.
Yep.
I mean, that's definitely among our ethics. I think being brought up traditionally conservative, I definitely think my Judaism impacts a lot of what I do, but probably to a degree subconsciously, although I definitely enjoy when my patients get a kick out of hearing me wish them a Shabbat Shalom. Big thing, we do this. I also think that medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics, and this has been in existence for a long time, are very real and more applicable and reasonable than some of the ethics that have come into medicine from other religions. And I don't want to go get too extreme about it. I think there's a lot of compassion in Judaism. I think even just the concept of holding a hand to be by someone when they're, you know, in frail times, hard times, passing times, to be with the body after someone's passed. I think subliminally, the Judaism plays a role.
Yeah.
And again, I can't make this up. Like non-Jewish patients just, they see Jewish doctor and it's like they link together and, you know, it equals like a really good equation.
Well, I mean, Judaism certainly, I mean, the obligation for pekuach nefesh to, you know, protect our health and protect life is a primary obligation. The obligation to visit the sick, like bikur cholim, like the rabbis say when we visit the sick, we take away 1/60th of their pain, like, which is the holding the hand. We have a lot of beautiful stuff in the tradition about the importance.
How'd they come up with 1/60th?
Oh, it's a rabbinic number that shows up in a bunch of different places. No. It's a very obscure thing. I was just quoting a piece from the Talmud. But I want to read two sentences from Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was a brilliant 20th century, one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century. And so Rabbi Heschel says, the doctor is God's partner in the struggle between life and death. Religion is medicine in the form of prayer. Medicine is prayer in the form of a deed. It is a grievous mistake to keep a wall of separation between medicine and religion. There is a division of labor, but a unity of spirit. I love this line coming up. The act of healing is the highest form of imitato Dei, which means imitation of God. To minister to the sick is to minister to God. So no pressure, you guys. But basically, what you're doing.
Have enough of
the time. Yeah, right. But
big shoes to fill.
Right, exactly. No, but I think it's actually, it's beautiful because it's not like there's, like, I love the way he weaves, you know, the religion and God and medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's your hands are almost like an extension of God's hands in the work you do in holding a hand and holding a patient.
A lot of patients will say that to me, actually.
Really? What do they say?
They just will say, you know, I'm in God's hands and I know that God works through you. So I pray for God, I pray for healing, but I pray for you to be guided by God. Wow. And that's patients of all different, of all different faiths.
I think it's like you said, nefesh, it's caring for the soul. And a good clinician, regardless of gender specialty, is caring for the person. And so much of that is caring for the soul.
Mm. Great. I want to open it up for questions in 1 minute. I just want to ask one more question. You both have touched on it a little bit, but how can women better advocate for themselves? How do we fix this sort of cycle that we're in? What's the corrective for it? What do you want to charge everyone here with to go out into the world and do differently?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things we've talked about is the stories about our health, the stories we've inherited. The hope with this book, when I wrote it, was that my editor said, well, do you want this to be prescriptive? You know, you're going to give like 10 steps, like the 10-step guide of like when you go on Good Morning America, these are the things that you must do. Or do you want to write a descriptive book of the problem? And then, you know, next book can be about what we're going to do about it. I really wanted to highlight the stories that we've inherited first. And if after reading this book, you can recognize yourself in that 17th century woman or the woman who, you know, had her teeth removed for having political opinions or whatever it may be, the woman that was called hysterical. If after reading this book, you can change the narrative about yourself, that was really my goal. So to think about what are the stories we've told ourselves, what are the mistruths that maybe we could correct, And then when we go to the doctor, some of the action items could be, as you said, coming with a friend, coming with questions, recognizing that it can be totally overwhelming to have a new diagnosis and to be anxious or concerned about mm-hmm. what's going on. And that can make it hard to really absorb medical information. So having an advocate with you is so important. And then if you don't have a doctor like you, finding one and not feeling like you have to suck it up with someone that you don't like.
I think everything Elizabeth said is 100% true. I think what I would add to that, particularly these days when people feel it's challenging to find a doctor, and you can go to an urgent care, and depending on your plan, you can bypass having an internist and get to the specialist. I think particularly for women, particularly for certain subgroups of our society, having whether it's an internist or one particular doctor that you can build a relationship with, because as we discussed earlier, and in the book, there's so many horrific things that go on, but you don't get the sense that these women could advocate for themselves. You need to advocate for yourself. You need your doctor to advocate for you. And I think particularly, again, for women, where we still either subconsciously feel something is going to be dismissed or someone is dismissing us. When you have a doctor in your back pocket who can be there and say, this is my patient, I'm sending them to the emergency room. I know she's going to look like she's 100% well. She's not. This is what's going on. This is what I'm concerned about. Really helps women and men get what they need. And I also think that particularly in this community, there's so many educated, strong, high-powered individual women here that take that moxie that you have in your professional life and bring it in a polite way to your physical life and your health world. And I think that that will serve everyone well.
I am going to call up Cantor Davis to close us out. So in addition to female physicians' voices not being heard for a long time, there, in addition to female rabbinic voices not being heard for a long time there were no female cantorial voices heard. In fact, there was a prohibition for what we call kol isha, the voice of a cantor. So I love the fact that we have female doctors, a female rabbi, and a female cantor all up here, correcting the old narrative and bringing us here. And of course, I'm going to let Cantor Davis talk about how we're going to close this and why.
I'm so excited to be here. I have so many medical stories I would love to share. Lovely memories. So as Rabbi Kaufman started to say, this prohibition on kol isha, I don't know how many of us are familiar with it, but it's about a female voice. And in a lot of Orthodox circles, there's actually no rabbinic or Torah precedent for this. There's nothing written down that says you can't listen to female voices. But for whatever reason, in a lot of Orthodox circles, women are not permitted to sing in front of men, lest the men be seduced by our voices. Which is somehow our problem and not their problem, but that's another story. And so I think to close out this program, I would love to share a couple songs. I think most of us know them. They're songs for healing. One is Moses's prayer for his sister, El Na'arfan Allah. And the other is Misha Berach, written by Debbie Friedman, written by a woman. So if everybody wants to sing with me.
Why don't we all rise?
Oh, yes, let's do that. El na'arfan Allah, El na'arfan Allah, Mi sheberach avoteinu, El na'arfan Allah, Mi sheberach.
Aseinu Mekor Abraha Leimoteinu. May the source of strength who blessed the ones before us help us find the courage to make our lives a blessing.
Thank you for listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.